If you could take your seats, please. Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it. Okay, everybody, we're getting ready to start now. Great, let's get started. So our third speaker today, thank you very much. So our third speaker today is someone who I would like to sort of introduce. You all know him. He doesn't really need the introduction, but I would like to thank Ziv in particular. Ziv is the main host. It's his the Japan Real Estate Podcast. He's the one who started it and publishes it, prepares it, puts it out together. A lot of what you see today is from Ziv's initiative and saying, hey, I want to get up to Tokyo and have some drinks on you guys. So let's do that. So really, really thank you very much, Ziv. I know myself and Tracy and anyone else you have on the podcast as well and on YouTube would not really be able to get this done if it weren't for you. So thank you so much. Now, please, Ziv, for all your investment side of real estate in Japan. Thank you so much, man. Looking forward to it.
Thank you for that, Emil. I'm not good with that, and I'm also not good with smiling on cue. So if somebody told me before that I'm not approachable, that is totally not true. I'm just not good at posing with, no, you're right. I know it comes off like that, but it's not because, yeah.
Louder still.
Okay, so Emil kind of introduced me. I run the Japan Real Estate Podcast, and my partner and I run Nippon Tradings International, which is a company that helps people. Initially, we were helping people only to invest in real estate in Japan. More and more, we were getting requests for different things. So holiday homes, land for development, Akiya properties, occasionally commercial properties. So we kind of do everything except what we're not needed for. So for example, if you're buying a family home in Tokyo, then we normally refer you to someone like Emil. If you're obviously interested in Minpaku, we refer you to somebody like Tracy. But in other parts of the country, as some of you probably know, if you've tried to purchase there, it's not as easy as it is in the bigger cities. Japan is still quite an insular society from a professional point of view on the real estate side. So we cover everything else that people need us to cover, whether it's purchase, sales, or management, but we are not a real estate agent or broker or a property manager. We work with third parties nationwide. So we're an added layer of service, an added layer of payment. But I think our customers think that it's worth their while. It saves them from a lot of costly mistakes and so forth, and just opens doors for them that normally wouldn't be open, depending on the area, depending on the type of property that they want to purchase. So we're like a buyer's advocate or a proxy or a management third party, single point of contact in English for all of your Japan real estate needs. So in February's summit, we were talking mainly about how to analyze investment deals. And we dug into a few, whether it's entire buildings or mansion rooms, individual condo units in co-owned blocks. Today, I know that Tracy mentioned magic spreadsheets. I actually want to take a step back from that and maybe try to cover a bit of more of a macro view, just to give people an idea of what's involved in each of the different asset classes that you might be considering for purchase for investment purposes. And more importantly, the type of buyer that each of these asset classes might or might not suit. So I've tried to map out some profiles of potential property investors or buyers. They're obviously archetypes, so I don't think that any of them would completely suit each and every one of you, but hopefully you can find at least some aspects of their goals or personality or circumstances that kind of gel with where you are in your property investment journey. So again, these are archetypes, don't take them seriously. So buyers, whoops. Hello. Let's not use that. Okay, so this is our first buyer. They're usually younger, or at least younger in their investment journey. They don't have that much saved. It could be their entire life savings, or it definitely is the entire amount that they can invest. And they're usually going to be quite sensitive about what they do with that money. And they normally have not invested yet, but they do have a concept of why they want to invest, and they realize that it's important toward whatever goal they're trying to achieve. And they're normally on the low to medium income side of the scale. So they're either entry-level company employees, or they're self-employed, but with small businesses. They could be fresh out of college, whatever the case may be. So this is typical buyer number one. Typical diamond. I've played with the genders, and there's not really that many stock images for gender fluid individuals, but I've done my best. So second buyer is a career person. Normally a person who's either employed by a company, but over a longer period of time, or a person who runs their own business or several businesses. And they tend to be more financially secure in many aspects, but they also have far, far less time on their hands to deal with whatever. So if Tracy was talking, for example, about Minpaku and how it's not passive income, that particular asset class, I'm not covering it here, but would definitely not suit the person who just doesn't have the time to deal with, fine tweak, and make the best of their investment portfolio on their own. They could definitely do it through third parties, but they just don't have the time or the mental bandwidth to deal with these kinds of properties. What they do have is more capital that they can use to alleviate issues that they run across along the way. So our first-timer buyer that we just looked at before would not have the option to do that. They need to be safe and stable with their income. This sort of buyer usually can allocate financial resources to either fix a problem, overcome a challenge, resell a property, renovate a property. We'll get into that in a minute. So these are our third types of buyers, not necessarily couples. I just picked a couple as an example. They usually are already invested in something similar to buyer profile number two. They usually already have a very clear idea of what they're doing with their savings, their retirement goals or next business goals. They know how much they're allocating for investment. They know how much they can afford to lose. And they're also at a stage of their professional career or personal lives where they do have the time. And more importantly, they do have the wish to actually fine tweak their portfolio and play with stuff and see how they can get creative with it. And in most cases, they're investments also are in line with what they might be doing now, or they might be considering a future lifestyle change. So these are, for example, the kind of people who buy an onsen resort, DIY it, and then go live with it themselves, manage it themselves, or they could be running a Minpaku business. People who are actively involved in the investments that they invest in, and they're also using their own personal skills and advantages and they leverage themselves into their investment, not just financially, but also personally with whatever they're strong at. They know that they're going to put that into whatever project they're working on. And our fourth, this is somebody who's usually at the later stages of their career. They definitely, same as the power couple, they definitely have their retirement mapped out, and they're actually now approaching the phase where they're starting to think about that. So while they do have maybe the time and mental bandwidth, they're not necessarily that interested. And obviously, every person is different, but they're not necessarily that interested in actually being physically and mentally involved in the investment. They just wanted to generate the cash that they are thinking that they should be generating from it. But if required, they could have either the financial capital or the time and mental bandwidth to deal with problems if required. But it's definitely not a main driver for them. What they do normally like to do is to make sure that everything is really operating smoothly and generating as much as it can in an Excel sheet kind of way, not in a physically involved kind of way. So what types of asset classes? So obviously, we're not going to say that this is not good for A, not good for B, not good for C, or 100% you should go invest in this and that. But we do try to at least point out the danger areas or the areas that might not be suitable for a particular profile of buyer, just to make sure that you're not buying into something that's not going to be suitable with either your financial goals or your financial situation, or your lifestyle and time resources. So asset number one is buildings. Normally we're not going to be buying a large reinforced concrete block. We're not fund managers, we're not sovereign funds. Normally investors, at least the ones that we work with, who are primarily cash buyers in Japan, there are definitely people who are eligible for a loan, but not all of them would like to leverage that, because a lot of you have probably used your borrowing capacity for your own personal loan. You might not have that much left for investment property. So it's either going to be a cash purchase or it's going to be partly a cash purchase. In some cases, it will be financed, but normally these are smaller wooden or steel framed wood structures. They start depending on the city and location. So here we're only referring to locations that we'd actually recommend as good investment locations. So either major metropolitan centers, obviously you're not going to find this in Tokyo, but in Yokohama, for example, you can find 35, 40, 45 million yen small buildings. The advantages that they have is they offer the best potential growth just from the aspect of having an entire land plot, which is, as is discussed again and again in Japan, the only thing that might gain in value is land. If you buy a small building, you have a larger land plot than if you buy, for example, a single unit in a condo. It does come with land, but you only get a slight portion of the land, which is divided between all unit owners in the building. Here you're owning the entire land plot. It gives you a lot more potential growth. It is also giving you a lot more flexibility. So with the mansion room, we'll get into that in a minute, but with the mansion room, there's very little that you can do to tweak your income, to get creative, to have access to a different tenant base. Those things just don't work with other types of properties. Here, depending on ward office regulations and zoning regulations, obviously, but here you have more flexibility, either with individual units in the building. You can rent them out, for example, to a commercial office. You can repurpose an entire floor. Again, they're made from wood or steel framed wood. Not that costly, for example, to unite two units into a larger one. You can use the top floor to rent out to a family, and the rest of them can be singles, rent out to offices, and let somebody open a shop on the ground floor, for example, depending on what the building looks like. You've got a lot more flexibility, as well as in the future, if for any reason you decide to demolish the building, build a new one, turn it into a parking lot, self-storage facility. I mean, the options are not endless, but they are at least there. So it does give you that flexibility. And the downside, or not necessarily the downside, but something to be aware of, is that structural maintenance and any repairs that need to be done are all on you. So there's no owner union, there's no reserve funds. Nobody except you is putting money aside to take care of the building down the track. So we normally recommend, depending on the age of the building, you might want to put 10, 15% aside of your gross rental income for this kind of future purpose. The important thing to remember is that you need to be thinking about this. So don't take all the money and then go do something else with it, because you will eventually need to maintain, repair, renovate, and so forth. Now, who are these not good for? Definitely not good for your first-time buyer, because this kind of person normally has no capital. And again, structural issues are going to be on the owner. And they normally don't have the capital to buy it in the first place, but they definitely don't have the capital to then pursue renovations, repairs, earthquakes, typhoon, Japan being Japan. If they cannot set the money aside to take care of a problem that arises in the property, it is probably not suitable for them, because this one offers potentially higher income, a lot more flexibility, but definitely does not give you the stability and safety that something, for example, we'll get to mansion rooms in a minute. Mansion rooms come with owner union fees that cover the renovations and the structural repairs of the building. And then you only need to worry about your interior, which can be a lot lower on the expense side, depending on the size of the property, but definitely nothing structural and nothing unexpected. The only thing that might happen that you're not expecting with a mansion unit is that monthly fees will go up at some point, but your rental income will always at least cover your structural expenses. Here, if the roof suddenly goes, that could be a year's worth of rental income that you'll have to suddenly fork out. And first-time buyers normally cannot afford to do that. Okay. Houses. Now, houses, they're tricky in Japan. We normally recommend to our customers unless they're experienced investors, unless they're going to be physically involved in running a business at the property, or at least physically involved in renovating, maintaining, and doing stuff at the property themselves, or are very well connected in the local community to be able to then access those resources to do stuff with the house, we would normally not recommend it as an investment asset of choice. Reason being that houses in Japan are normally not built to last. As most of you probably know, you can get a custom-made brick or concrete house, but normally that is not going to be the case. And while you can buy them very, very cheap, and they're definitely flexible, again, same as buildings, with repurposing or reusing for different sources, as they get older, the maintenance rises quite rapidly. And with the house, again, unless you're running it as a minpaku hospitality property, some kind of business, a house is normally going to be a single income stream. So with the buildings, which are also made of wood, number one, they're built to last a little bit better than houses, but most importantly, they have multiple income streams of several units in them. With a house, if a tenant moves out, or for some reason you have to kick a tenant out because you have to do some major structural work on the house, your income immediately goes down to zero. So that's something to consider when you're purchasing a house. However, if it is DIY labor of love type project, there's a few faces here in the crowd that definitely do that on a regular basis, completely different matter. But as a safe and stable, reliable, easily handled asset class, we would probably not recommend them to many people, at least not without them being aware of and prepared for what might come with it. So who are these not good for? And they're definitely not good for a career person who just does not have the time to deal with it. So even if you have the money to throw at these problems, like most career people, or at least some of them definitely have, the mental bandwidth required to deal with the renovation of the house, a repair of the house, doing something creative with it, running a business, this is not something that a person on a full-time job or running a business on their own can handle. So we would probably advise, again, this is not a definite no-no, but we would probably advise to people who just don't have the time and the mental bandwidth to deal with it to not go for this as an asset class. Now, condo units, everyone's favorite usually, or mansion rooms, as they're known here. Advantages are obviously that annual expenses are in most cases predictable. So this all comes with the due diligence, which we've talked about in a previous presentation, and I can give you links to download those. But the monthly building fees that you're paying, both for management of the building and the grounds, and for the future reserve fund renovations and large scale repairs and so forth, these are fairly predictable. They will go up over time as the building ages. And as it approaches, let's say 40 years of age, they will go up much more rapidly and definitely beyond that. But you do know that what you're paying monthly covers you for all of these unexpected sort of happenings might occur while you're owning and renting out these properties. So they are very safe and predictable in that sense, even if they're not as high yielding as other asset classes, which is not always the case. Some of them can be very much so. But as mentioned, almost no flexibility in use. The most tweaking, say, that you can get out of a condo unit would normally be monthly rentals. You would definitely not be able to rent it out real short-term rentals like a minpaku on Airbnb. You're not going to be able to list it unless the owner union specifically notes in the owner union rulebook that that's allowed. But as anyone running a minpaku knows, 99.99999% of them will just never allow that in the building. And since 2018, the government has given them the default right to ban it by omission from the owner union rulebook. So the most you'll be able to do is rent them out by the month. And there are definitely property managers that do that as a main line of the business. Mika-san over there is one of those, for example. But what they do is they work around the owner union. So the owner unions don't like the fact that you're renting it out by the month, but legally they can't really do much about it. All they can do is make your property manager's life difficult, occasionally the guest's life a bit difficult, but property managers who handle this on a regular basis know how to deal with that. And they'll also tell you if it becomes too much, they'll say, look, this is just not happening. So might switch back to long-term rentals. But that's the only tweak you'll be able to do with these. Some buildings specifically allow commercial rentals as well. So you'll often see lawyers, accountants, people that don't actually need walk-in traffic like a shop. You'll often see them renting out these places as offices, but that's only in case the owner union allows it, which again is a small percentage of these properties. So commercially, you will occasionally see some big reinforced concrete buildings, obviously with shops and offices on the ground floor. But beyond that, vast majority of them are normally long-term residential properties. Some particular buildings dedicate particular floors to hotel type businesses, which you can then buy into and kind of sublease it from the owner union or from the management company running the building. But those are very limited in usage. And if and when they decide that they're not leasing it for that much anymore, like during Corona, for example, we have a few customers with these types of properties. We just get a letter saying that unfortunately there are no tourists and we're now reducing your sublease that we're paying you every month by 20, 30, 40%. Not much that you can do with that, except resell the property. But obviously, with less rental income, it's not going to be as attractive to potential investors who are going to buy it from you. So not a highly recommended these types of hotel suites within reinforced concrete buildings. But the advantages is that long-term tenants are hassle-free, mainly hassle-free. It's Japan, so there's no there's very rarely payment issues. If you do need to evict someone, it's normally a case of sending them a letter and asking them to leave. You're not going to have to deal with anything on a regular basis like you would do, like Tracy was saying, minpaku. And to a point, monthly rentals is not really passive income. I don't like to use the term passive income generally, but this is probably as close to passive income as you can get is with these long-term residential or even commercial leases. We can talk later about the difference between commercial and residential if you want, but generally speaking, they're hassle-free. The income is predictable, the expenses are predictable, and they are easy to tenant in most cases because most Japanese singles, couples, and even families, if they're renting, most of them are renting condo units. So the tenant base is a lot larger than what you'd have for other properties. For a house, for example, which is always going to be, not always, I shouldn't say, but in most cases going to be a family renting a house, Japan's population trends being what they are, it's a lot easier to find a single tenant or a couple than it is to find a family to move into a property that you're renting out. The lease terms on average could be shorter, but at least you're never short on tenants to lease to. Assuming a bunch of other factors like location, competition in the area, average rents, and so forth, but they're generally easier to find tenants for. Who are they not right for? This could be just my own opinion, but they're not really right for anyone who's looking for anything creative to do with their investment portfolio. So if you're the type of person who's constantly going to ask your property manager, hey, how can we make this earn a bit more money? Or how can we tweak this? Or how can we find different types of tenant? Or can we turn this into this? You want to DIY project the interior of the property yourself. There are better asset classes for you to do that with. There is not much that you're going to be doing with these condo units except advertise them with the property manager at the recommended rent that the property manager believes that area and that type of property can yield. Reduce it, tweak it, raise it a little bit in between tenants if you can, but not much beyond that. So that can be very frustrating to somebody who's investing because they want to be hands-on. This is not a hands-on investment in most cases, unless you want to manage your own property without a property manager, but that's a whole different kettle of fish, especially in Japan. I would probably not advise to do that. And lastly, land. So you could definitely be buying land for all sorts of purposes. A lot of our customers definitely do that. We even have some customers who are just buying it to sit on it and hope that land banking, in a sense, hope that the value will go up. Some people are specifically buying land in areas with water rights or close to resorts that they think might become more popular in the future. It can be very speculative and prospective sort of investment, but it's the most flexible of the investment asset classes. So if you're buying just vacant land and you have the capital to then construct something on it and do something creative with it down the track, it's definitely a good place to start, especially if you can identify areas that are gaining in popularity for various reasons. And there's a bunch of areas like that in Japan. Zoning regulations can be complex with land. So First off, when you purchase it, you need to see if it's classified as agricultural land, forest land, residential land, mixed zone commercial, single zone commercial. There's various levels of that that Emil is probably a lot more familiar with than I am. But depending on what you're planning to do with the land, you really want to make sure pre-purchase that you're going to be able to do that down the track. And also zoning regulations change over time. So we mentioned previously the width of the access road, for example, leading into the property. Is it going to be possible to build a structure on it? What kind of structure? Can it be rebuilt in the future? That might depend on what you've built on it in the first place. What is the ratio of the structure and the floor space to the land area? You also want to look more carefully on not necessarily legal issues, but you want to look more carefully at the community around you. What's the purpose of the purchase? What are you going to be building there? Will the community be open to it? Are you going to be facing resistance? All of these things are going to be very much vague and gray when you first approach a vacant plot of land, unless you're already familiar with the area, you've been living there and you know all these things. And obviously it requires the largest amount of capital from everything we've discussed. So whatever you want to build will cost you, unless it's maybe one single storage shed, it's going to cost you more than anything else that we've discussed so far. You're buying something and building something on it brand new. It does require more capital than other types of investments, at least on construction. Who is it not good for? I would say definitely not for the first-time buyer. They don't have that kind of capital. They're normally working hard to make ends meet, so they're also not going to have the time resources to handle a project like that. And again, same sort of story as with the houses. It's probably not suitable for somebody who's fully employed, even if they do have the capital, unless it's part of their retirement plan. So if they are thinking forward to the future and they're buying the land and they're sitting on it because they know that in 5, 10, 15 years, but that's probably more relevant to a retiring Randy over there than it is to somebody in the midst of their career. So that's something that you probably be considering if you've got the time and effort and you're in a stage in your life where you're able to do that. And you can put the time and effort, and the capital into it, then that might be a suitable asset class for you. But definitely not if you don't have the time or the money or even the plan and the business plan and the idea to deal with it. I wouldn't focus on development projects if you're not in a development phase in your life. Just on time. So we can open to Q&A or we can just give you a longer break. That is entirely up to you. Go for it.
That is going to be developing property that might only, or is there a way to just be able to put in money and not have to worry about somebody else managing?
Okay, so the question is it possible to buy into an existing group or project, I'm assuming, that is going to take place? So it is possible if you're buying as a shareholder into a company that is going to do it on your behalf. It's also possible, we've just done that recently, and developers, for example, will purchase a plot of land and put together the blueprint and announce that they're going to build such and such project on it. And if you're interested, then you apply for a mortgage or put in the capital, and then the developer constructs what they had in mind from the get-go. But when they're done, you still have to manage it. They can probably recommend and often put in place property managers for you, depending on the type of property and what it requires, but it will still be under your own management. The other option is to join a syndication of a group of investors who are doing that. That's maybe a topic for a completely different presentation, but that could be done with everybody with equal voting rights. It could be done with a management entity in place that everybody puts trust in as the managing partner. It could be an existing syndication that you're joining because they've advertised it looking for members, or it could be one that you're forming on your own. And if you are forming it on your own, then again, you can decide if you want to be hands-on or not, or we're going to appoint, it's not a fund manager, but something like a managing director in place who's going to run the property. The options are definitely there, yes. Any other questions? Yes, please. When you purchase land, how much tax are you going to pay every year? That very, very, very much depends on the location. I'm no tax accountant, so I can't speak to that directly. But to my understanding, vacant land and land with structures on it are taxed differently. Agricultural land that is not being used for agriculture purposes is taxed differently. That's something to deal with on a local municipality and the tax accountant, obviously. But that information should be available from listing realtors and sellers. And if it's not, then it's definitely something that you can research with local city hall, either yourself or via Shihochoshi, who can go and retrieve that information for you. Yes. The lady in the back, sorry. So for the people, especially in the stream and in the front rows, what Emil was saying is that undeveloped land, correct me if I'm wrong, Emil, because I also kind of heard a bit of it. So undeveloped land is taxed at a discount, developed land is taxed at a discount, which is why people often just construct a little car park on it to get that taxable discount, right? Yeah. Okay. Yes. No. Lady in the back, she's been waiting a long time. Sorry. Can't hear. Okay, say it into the mic, then the streamers can hear it.
Okay. Yeah, just clarifying question. The asset class, like the first couple of them you mentioned, they're flexible for repurposing. Is it repurposing between residential and commercial? Is it mixed, or do they actually have different zoning requirements? Can you repurpose a multi-unit residential property to a commercial or vice versa, or are they actually separate?
So probably don't need to repeat the question, you heard it. So the question is relating to, can you repurpose a property from residential to commercial purposes? The answer is that it very much depends on the local zoning regulations in that area. So a lot of Japan is a lot less strict in zoning regulations than a lot of other countries around the world, but there are still strictly residential areas, strictly residential streets or neighborhood in which it's not going to be possible. And it also depends on the kind of business. So zoning regulations that specify, for example, mixed purpose, residential and commercial, may or may not include walk-in traffic. Shops, restaurants might not be allowed, but the office or a small shop may be allowed. So that's totally a local, not even a local municipality, a local street and neighborhood regulation. And that's, again, something that you need to check. All listings should have that information. The listing realtor should have that information to provide to you before you purchase. Yes, sir. Okay, so the question is if it can be at least generally classified, what sort of yield or rate of return you could expect from each of these different investment classes. I can give you statistics based on our experience and based on sort of industry, I don't even want to say standards, but let's call it the industry case studies. In Japan, and also it changes over time, right? When we started, which was about 12 years ago now, Japan was still in very much in the doldrums post 25 years of inflation, and we were getting returns even in big cities like
not Tokyo, but Osaka, Fukuoka, we were getting returns like crazy, 12, 13% net before tax. These days, if we get six and a bit, we're extremely happy. So obviously, macro market factors change this a fair bit. At the moment, I can say that entire small buildings, as long as they're, let's say, 3-4 floors, not beyond that, not at the point where you might want to consider putting an elevator in there, and individual condo units, again, depending on the city, would normally generate somewhere between 3 to 6% net before tax, which I think gives you a rate of return, a term of return of something like 18 years or 17 years. And we can have a different conversation about how to work that out. But the development projects carried on by professional developers who are doing this for a living on a regular basis, normally a good rate of return would be something like, also depends if you're buying to rent, buying to sell. If you're developing a project and then planning to sell it once it's done, which is normally, let's say, between 2 to 4 years, the kind of accepted industry standard tends to be somewhere between 20 to 30% of your capital, roughly. Depends on the project, and obviously depends if you're experienced, and tailwinds, headwinds, everything else plays into that. With houses, it's very difficult for me to say that. We, of about 300 plus properties under managed, only have a single customer who actually owns a single family residential home that's being rented out to a long-term tenant. He's bought that 7-8 years ago now. It's in Sapporo, and he's making great returns compared to the price he bought it then. I think 7-8%, not much maintenance, but he's been very, very lucky. Houses, the expenses on houses, especially on the older houses, vary hugely. So every weather occurrence affects you. The roof goes, if you're in colder climate, there's stuff like snow clearing that needs to be done. If you're in warmer climates, there's mold, there's termites, there's stuff that you don't need to put up with other asset classes. So it's difficult for me to say. I have friends who are, again, hands-on, and Anton will talk about that in his presentation in a few minutes. But if you're very much hands-on and you know how to save on all of these maintenance and renovations, or at least you have good contractors that you're familiar with, or you can save on these costs, it is definitely possible to get high returns from a house. But again, it's very, very much time consuming and mental bandwidth consuming. So we don't recommend it to somebody. Like I take myself as an example. I obviously I'm as far away from DIY as anyone can possibly be. I'm horrible at that. But aside from not being physically horrible at that, I like a lot better to focus on the next deal, right? I want to finalize the deal, make sure it's returning as much as I think it can be returning. Occasionally go back and fine tweak if I can, but I always want to expand the portfolio and look at, I want to spend my time on the next deal on in the pipeline that I want to invest in. So to deal with all of the issues that come up with these, especially older houses, is just not suitable for my personality type. So it's hard for me to estimate the returns on those. Yes, please.
If you buy empty lot from a developer, are you resorts? Yes, yes.
You mean a resort property? Like
a resort property, empty lot. Are you obligated to use their contractor, like a builder?
So I'll repeat the question. Tell me if I got it right. So you're asking if you're buying a unit in a serviced resort, like the ones they have around ski slopes, for example, or around onsen resort, are you going to be specifying who is the contractor who's going to build the? So you're referring not to a built property, but to a parcel of land in the resort. Is that what you mean?
No. Are you obligated to use the contractor? They have a relationship.
For renovations or for building? Okay, so resorts very much vary depending on the resort company that developed the project. Some of them will pre-develop everything themselves and it's kind of cookie cutter type homes. Some of them will just sell land plots and give you the permission. We work, for example, in Karuizawa a lot. a lot of the resorts there have completely different houses. So it's very clear that it's not the same contractor who built all of them. Some of them are log cabins, some of them are traditional. So it really depends on the resort and how it's being developed. But some of them will definitely not just make you work with, not just force you to work with their specified contractor, but also limit you in the type of property that you can choose. So the contractor would have a catalog and you'd have to choose property A, B, C, or D. So it very much depends on the resort company. Any other questions? Yes.
Have you seen anything like converting a storage or a factory into condo?
I've definitely seen it done, but bear in mind that factories and warehouses are normally constructed in very much industrial zones. So you want to make sure that whatever you're building there will be desirable for tenants. And also you want to make sure, because it's not just a matter of the entire floor space, but also how many floors you might be able to build there, depending on nearness to airports, whatever the case may be. So you want to look carefully into the zoning, but yes, it's definitely doable. Yeah.
Yes.
So
based on the 12 years of observation, what type out of the four types that you know, 6%, 7% property effect of the year?
Okay, so I'll repeat the question. Based on our experience, which of these asset classes tend to generate the best capital growth? I would say that that is a lot more location dependent than it is asset class dependent. So for example, tiny little 12 square meters condo units without even a balcony that we've purchased in very central locations in very big cities, even though they come with a tiny fraction of land, and they've more than doubled or 2.5 in capital since we purchased them, just because they're in the heart of the city. They're always going to be tenanted. And it's one of those rare locations in Japan where you can actually raise the rent at least a little bit when you renew a lease or when a tenant moves out. But if we're comparing, let's say, apples to apples, let's say same location, different asset classes, it's really about the land. So if the land plot is large enough, is larger, then you're going, and the area gains in value, then you're going to be gaining more. So houses, for example, especially if they're a little bit more suburban, often come with a small structure on a relatively large plot of land. Buildings might come with the same kind of same size plot of land, but there's a bigger structure on it. In both cases, capital growth would be the same if that was being sold to somebody as a non-investment property, right? Because the land value went up in price. But investment properties in Japan are very much priced on the rental income that they generate. So in two comparable cases, same kind of land plot. One is, let's say, an older family home with a single elderly tenant that's passed away and you just buy it off their descendants. Or a building that's already generating income from multiple units. Unless you're a developer, the building generating a rental income is going to be priced depending on the yield that it generates. So if rents have gone down over the years, then it's going to be potentially worth less than what you bought it for. If rents have gone down, but the area has gone up in value, it might stay the same. If rents have gone up, which is a rarity again in Japan, then it definitely the value of the asset we've got. So I guess it depends on whether it's already an investment property or something that you're purchasing to then turn into an investment property. Sorry, it depends, I guess, like Tracy was saying. Yeah. Yes.
Wait. Sorry, we've only got one microphone today. So if it's from the back, I'll go back there.
So I know you mentioned about syndication earlier, so I have a specific question about syndication. If, say, like a case where you have more than three foreign investors who want to get a loan, would the bank usually underwriting the loan based on one of the foreign investors' credit, or do all three of them have to submit their credit for the underwriting purposes, in your experience?
Yeah. And do we need a local guarantor?
So I'll repeat the question and then I'll let Emil probably address that, because loans is his forte. So the question was, if you are syndicating, how would the bank then assess the loan? Is it based on each individual investor who is a part of the syndication? Is it based on them combined, and so forth.
Three investors set up a legal entity, the new legal entity in Japan.
Okay, so, all right, so I generally deal with home loans. So in terms of syndication or whatnot, I don't have experience with that. But banks, for a home loan, that doesn't make sense because that's not no longer your personal home, right? It's for syndication or for business. So in general, for the typical loans I deal with, no, they won't actually do that. Even if you want to think of an even more familiar scenario, a brother and sister or siblings cannot get a joint home loan to buy a property. Of course it's correct. a parent and a child, you know, like someone with the, you know, some 40s and a 70-year-old parent, they can do that because that is not uncommon in Japan, where they have like, you know, the parents or the grandparents live with the their kids' family. So that is okay. But siblings, they say no, because if at one stage one of the siblings wants to get married and move, then how is this home loan? How is this still a viable home situation? There's going to be difficulty. So with syndication, no, it's even more difficult. But the other one about if you incorporate a business and have multiple direct or owners in that building, for that company, then yes, that could work. I don't actually have experience with that, but I do know, for example, I mentioned in my presentation, there's a business loan where a non-resident can establish a corporation in Japan, and then that corporation gets a property investment loan, about 60% financing. And in that case, you can have multiple owners in that KK or in that corporation that's established in Japan. So that could work. The only discussion I've had so far with that bank has been with a husband and wife as the owners, and they haven't mentioned anything about that. So it's possible that it could happen. It's also possible that that they sell, even if one person gets the original loan, that they sell the ownership or transfer some ownership of that KK to other members of the syndicate. So I can imagine that is probably a more realistic scenario, but I don't have direct experience doing that, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. So maybe you already covered this earlier. What are you seeing in terms of foreigners buying here? Is it just pure cash purchases?
For resident foreigners or non-residents? So for non-resident right now, we just had a guy who lives in Dubai. I just showed him. He made an offer on a property. It's cash in Ueno. That's like about 199 million yen. Mostly cash purchases. The ones that are doing and that's like as a holiday house. We haven't really had someone successfully overseas yet establish a company and get the financing for it. The big hurdle with that is having, like, the entity in Japan, when it's established, needs to get a bank account. And Japanese laws are very strict for money laundering. Even myself, when I started my company, I went to SMBC and Rizona, and they would not allow me to open a corporate bank account for my company. The company's new, we don't know what it does. And it's not because I'm a foreigner, even for Japanese, they have similar issues, right? So then I had to open with a local, like a credit union in Setagaya that I work with. Now, maybe I've got some more years of financials. I could try one of the other bigger banks, but there's no need for me at this stage. But if you have someone open a company and they are non-resident directors, so they live in the US, that's going to be very, very difficult. I'm in the process now. I've got one client who's very keen on doing that. So I've discussed with the lawyers and the accountants that if I establish a company and I'm the local representative director and they are the company owner, is there any legal risk for me if they default on the loan, etc.? And the next step. Yeah, okay. Yeah, similar thing. So that's like another sort of version of the business where I established a company in Japan and because I'm resident and get the bank account for it locally, and they are 100% the owner. And I just get like a small salary for being the liaison for that company. That's what we're trying to move forward with, but we haven't actually succeeded in a case yet. But we haven't, that's in the process of starting. So I can't answer with confidence that yes, that's that will work.
But what is the answer to that? I mean, in terms of legal liability, do you have liability to your
act? Me being the representative director, not really. There's no legal liability.
So even if people default,
as long as I'm not on the property, as long as I'm not on the property loan to say that I take responsibility. A lot of business loans will want the director to be a co-signer on the loan. So that's something I should not do. And even I can quit the company or step down from that role shortly after established. But there's no significant legal liability unless there is. If the company does something bad, like bad behavior, then yes, the director is responsible. In this case, it's just a holding entity. They're not really doing anything, any operation. And then the other thing is often the investor will have about 50% of the property value invested in it. So if they buy a 100 million yen property, the bank's giving them 60%. They've put in 40% equity plus another 10%. So if they do default or if they do just disappear, the property is still there. The company, they've actually put in 40% of it. So there's a lot of money in there that if the bank does sell it, the company will still have cash. So the risk is quite low. So that's something that we're inquiring about right now. The lawyer and the accountant have said it's okay. Now we're just onto the bank. I'm speaking with some banks about, are they okay with this scheme? Because I might be able to do it once with one bank, but if I step down and the bank turns around and says, hey, you're no longer the director, what about for now I'm opening a second company, a third company, a fourth company, they're like, hey, what are you doing? They won't give me the bank account anymore. So you want to have everyone on board that they know, like you want the bank on board that does the financing, the scriveners and accountants on board, and also the bank that gives you the bank account. You want them to all understand what you're doing and this is your business model. And so it's sustainable and you can carry on with multiple clients, not just once off and then burn all your bridges.
I'll just slightly add to that as I'm walking back there. There are cases, if you've got an existing company in place and that company is in business that is somehow related to property and it's been doing it for a while, and then the bank definitely takes that into account. So whether it's a syndication or it's investment loan, if there is a company in place that's already been operating for a while, most of the time in Japan, but they might actually consider your activities overseas. If it's an overseas company, then they will definitely take it into account. On the investment loans for individual, there's a bank in Singapore, I think UOB, I've got the product brochure, that will let you borrow for long-term residency condo units only. For some reason, they don't do landed property, but if you're buying a condo unit or a mansion room, they will give you an investment loan, even if you're not a resident of Japan and you will not have to set up a company. The interest rate is higher. It's about 3.5% from memory. And it's only granted to people residing in countries where that bank has a presence. But there's a bunch of these countries. Most of them are definitely in the USA and so forth. So that's another option as well. And last question, because we really have to wrap up. UOB, right? Yeah, I think UOB or DBS. I don't, there was one of them that was doing it a while back and now another one. But I think it is UOB, yeah, from memory. I'll give you the product brochure if you remind me. All right, thank you very much.